You pressed play on this podcast with the click of curiosity. It is another dimension, a dimension of mind, a dimension where nothing is sacred and everything is explainable. You're streaming into a land of both inside and outside, of things and ideas. You've just crossed over into the midside.
Welcome to the midside, where what the hell is a talkie? I'm your host, Justin Emelzieski, blah, 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 can't say my own name, the hopeful bromantic, and I retroactively and proactively denounce anything anyone has ever said and ever will say on this show.
Way to step on about, it, Justin.
Yeah, step on my own name.
On your name.
On my own name. Well, this season we talked about at the beginning how like every year, every couple years has had a theme, and I posited, I think it was me. Can I take my credit, my own credit for this, William?
Yeah, I think you can. Yeah.
100%. I can take my credit for...
Yeah.
100%.
Did you get the CM Punk 100% drop yet?
Oh, God, I keep forgetting that's the one you want. Send it to me again and I will.
Because what needs to happen is at one point I need to say 100% and then you hit the Snyder and the CM Punk
and then
drop
CM Punk,
in a row.
Yes, we will get it. We'll get it.
But so I'm going to claim 100% credit.
All right.
I'm supposed to hit the 100. There we go. Okay.
Way to step on it, Justin.
God damn it. I said, let's keep this episode concise. 80 drops in the intro. So we talked about the theme of this season possibly being that we're past peak woke, and we've seen some sort of signs of it. And I think this week we have a lot of we're past peak woke. Now, I think one of the stories is sort of, what are the dangers of being past peak woke and battling it? But I think we got some positive signs this week. But first, as you've already heard, I have to bring in my co-host. Joining me from his corner office, identifying as a woman to forgo his white male gay privilege, William Green.
Hello, hello. Well, Justin, I am officially an old man. This is the first podcast where I'm wearing my brand new computer glasses for use with the computer. Went to the optometrist a month and a half ago around my birthday. Got my eyes checked. Everything's good. 20/15 in one eye, 20/20 in the other eye. I can't see shit up close. I'm starting to get old. So I'm actually wearing computer glasses now.
I have a question.
Sure.
Are these being farsighted glasses or are these those blue light special glasses, which I thought originally that you like wore when you went to Kmart?
They have a blue blocker coating on them, so they look a tiny hint, you know, of reflective blue, but it's basically like, think of them as like bifocals, but I don't need the bifocals, right? Like, so they're a little bit progressive towards the bottom, so I can see things better up close. Yeah, I was getting really hard when I was working on computer shit, like reading the, you know, the really tiny part numbers, you know, and things like that. I was having a hard time. So,
you got to do what the rest of us do, William.
I know.
You take a picture on your phone and zoom in on the picture to read it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'll have to do that, but not with these
glasses.
You haven't
figured that out yet?
No, I did. I have been doing that.
Okay.
But
if you turn the brightness up on your screen, it's easier to see things.
Yeah.
Look, I have these problems too, right? Like, this is probably the most irrational thing I have. I have that problem too, where things are blurry up close. I have the also problem where my right ear hurts sometimes when there's loud things such as a pop punk show, but I just don't go to the doctor or tell the doctor about it. Probably the most irrational thing I do.
Probably. Well, since I'm on the computer all the time, I figured I should not suffer in silence and actually take the plunge. And it actually helps a lot. I'm an old man now. I have my computer glasses.
I love how he says now he's an old man.
Well, I've been getting younger every year. This is the first, regression, if you can call it that. Maybe it's a sign
of
maturity.
Now, we're middle-aged. How are you getting younger every year?
I don't know. I still look like I'm in my 30s, dude.
I do, too. Don't get me wrong. That doesn't make us not middle-aged.
That's true. Well, we do shout, get off my lawn a lot and yell at clouds a lot.
Yeah.
Speaking
I'm just
of.
This look, so right now we're middle aged, so this podcast is in like this sort of middle ground, but give us another 15 years and then we'll finally be the old people like Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew are now, where they're annoyed at everything. And that's when we're really going to hit our stride.
Yeah, that's
true. This podcast is going to blow up 25, 30 years into the podcast.
Yep. Everyone will be begging for the drops from the early seasons.
100%.
100%.
All right. Life on the Bedside. Go. There's not really some, no, we just complaining. I hope that this mic is on, 'cause I'm on a roll here. I hope this is making some sense. I hope that you throw up your hands and sing it and tell all the haters that they should just shut up and smile. Yeah. As always, if you'd like to support the show, you can do so through Patreon or Locals. Patreon is per episode, Locals is per month. That's themidside.com/Patreon or themidside.com/Locals. We accept any and all support, including affirmations, because as we're about to see in the next story, which is a follow-up from last week, it really is all about just parroting the catchphrases of the social in-group. To end last episode, William, we talked about the story written by, am I correct here, NPR's senior editor Yuri Berliner? That was the guy?
Right. Yep.
Yeah. He wrote all about, hey, this is why NPR has lost the mainstream audience. And since
we broke
then,
it down.
He
had some, you know, he seemed to miss some things, but he had a lot of really good things in there.
He had a lot of really good things, but I said he had one fundamental issue, which I think rears its ugly head in this follow-up story. This is something that you had been updating me on throughout the week. You had been sharing, we touched on it, right? The new NPR CEO, Catherine Maher, however you want to say it.
I think it's like Bill Maher. I think it's like that.
Bill Maher.
It looks almost, it almost looks the same, doesn't it?
It does look the same, but I don't, dude, fucking two people have the exact spelled name the same and they tell you to pronounce it differently. You know how hard it is teaching public school?
You can barely pronounce
you can't even pronounce
name.
Fucking kids.
Yeah.
No, that's fine. Like, I don't even care, dude. Nobody knows Polish people around here. So
that's
like, you don't need to. But like, it'll literally be like Steve and Steve, and they'll be like, no, it's Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, yeah. And I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? And they couldn't pronounce Steven because they thought the PH was pronounced differently than the V. They were like, oh, we thought it was Stefan. So they thought it was Steven and Stefan. Like, it's just ridiculous. Anyway, so we talked about the tweet she had, right? Well, apparently this has blown up even more. So I want to read some stuff from.
Well, let me give the context before you get into the tweets, because throughout the week, I think it was Christopher Ruffo or somebody, you know, somebody who covers these sort of woke academic stories, just was randomly tweeting just tweets from her history, just like retweeting them and like just saying like, you know, giving the historical timeline of like what events were going on while this person was tweeting these things, you know? And it was just, for me, it was funny and entertaining. That's why I kept sending them, because it was just like, it was a chatbot, which we'll sort of get into, right? It's just an AI chatbot of wokeness. So let's get into it, because I think the farce is strong with this one.
Yes. And the first thing to start with here is, this is all coming from a City Journal article, but I thought there was a hilarious headline from the New York Post where they say that this woman's life is the ultimate woke elite bingo card, because that plays into the first paragraph here. Catherine Maher has a golden resume with stints and affiliations at UNICEF, the Atlantic Council, the World Economic Forum, the State Department, Stanford University, and the Council on Foreign Relations. She was chief executive officer and executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation. And as of last month, she is the CEO of National Public Radio.
That's right. 100%.
I mean, you're same right. thing, right? But I mean, isn't that like a woke bingo card right there?
Dude, I mean, people are even, this is branching out, Justin. People are like scratching their head and like, wait, she was chairman of the board or something, or on the board or CEO of Wikimedia, right? And people are like, what is going on? How can someone so anti-free speech be on the Wikipedia board, right? Or be in a leadership position on the board and stuff like that? And now people are investigating, well, how much money does Wikipedia have to be funding all these anti-free speech things that are all coming out based on analyzing her tweets? And Justin, that's having a big effect. This is having secondary effects now, not just NPR. Yeah. I think Wikipedia is under the fire now, too.
Well, I mean, the question you have to have, and we'll get to this at the end of these paragraphs here, is how deep does this go? How deep does the rabbit hole go? And I was not, you know, I'm not a fan of the whole, you know, deep state thing in the sense of this giant conspiracy. But
yeah, yeah.
I do think that there is something to be said about a group of people who network, especially, we've talked about this before, especially in social media, right? We saw journalists working together in Facebook groups to push the same narrative. I think this is an example of this, right? Because this article on City Journal is supposing that beyond the whole Berliner, Ich bin Berliner, that's not what it means, but yes, that means I am a Berliner and I live in Berlin. But no, besides that controversy, right, his residing and everything, this article is saying she has another problem. The author says it's her tweets. But what it really is it's the way she speaks. Like you said, she speaks almost like AI. The article says, what you notice first about her public speech are the buzzwords and phrases, structural privilege, epistemic emergency, transit justice, non-binary people, late stage capitalism. That's what we've talked about before, William, right? Like,
yeah.
How do these people just decide we're in late stage capitalism? Like, that would be something that you would look at 500 years in the future and be
that's capitalism has not been around that long. Like, compare it to feudalism and then tell me we're in late stage capitalism.
Well, and that and you, how do you get to decide you're in late stage when you're in it?
Yeah, that's true.
Unless it's a game and they tell you you're in the third quarter. Like, you don't know if it's the third quarter or not, you know? All right. Cis white mobility privilege. We talked about that one last week. It's not what you think it is. It's not you're not in a wheelchair. It's if you can move, right? Like,
move house,
states,
as they say, the British say.
The politics of representation, folks, which just looks like somebody took the letter L and mistyped it in the word fox. She supported Black Lives Matter from its earliest days. She compares driving cars with smoking cigarettes. That's another big one on the internet. The idea of, have you seen this a lot, William? I don't hear this in real life, but I see it online all the time, that the worst things about America is it's a car-dependent culture. Do you see that?
Yeah. I challenge any country as large as the United States to do anything other than use cars. I mean, cars is...
Because trains are going to work.
Yeah, there's no... I mean, what are we going to do, fly? Ride a horse?
Well, the flying will obviously pollute the air. So she's very concerned about toxic masculinity. That's a topic we've talked about ad nauseum on the show. On every topic, she adopts the fashionable language of left-wing academic theory and uses it as social currency, even when her efforts veer into self-parody. Isn't that a tagline for our show?
Dude,
uses it as
I want to make a website, and I may do it if I get bored this afternoon, that pulls up a random one of her tweets and one of Tatiana, you know, Tatiana, the parody account that is the woke parody account that just talks about all sorts of woke things. I'm just going to have a game where it picks a random tweet from one or the other, and you have to guess which one it is.
Woke or joke.
It's like woke or joke. Yeah, it's woke or joke. And I bet it's going to be impossible to win.
Well, there was that... Wasn't there that MGTOW website that we found? Did we talk about it on air or off air?
Where we couldn't tell if it was a seriously made website or not? Yeah.
This is the same thing, is it not?
That would be the best timeline. If, like, next week it comes out that she's actually Tatiana, the guy that is the author of Tatiana's tweets. That would be hilarious.
Then I would have to check and make sure Kobe was still dead, because if we just went into that timeline, I would assume Kobe was alive and Brady never left New England. Justice League got released. We just warped back to the prime timeline, and we're not in this evil parallel universe anymore.
No more Kelvin.
No more Kelvin timeline, She never explains, never provides new interpretation. She just repeats the phrases in search of affirmation and when the time is right, a promotion. She understands the game. America's elite institutions reward loyalty to the narrative. Those who repeat the word move up. Those who don't move out. And then it ends. The new CEO of NPR, then, is a left-wing ideologue who supports wide-scale censorship and considers the First Amendment an impediment to her campaign to sanitize the world of wrong opinions. She is no aberration. She is part of a rising cohort of affluent left-wing female managers who dominate the departments of university administration, human resources, and DEI. They're the matriarchs of the American longhouse. They value safety over liberty, censorship over debate, and relativism over truth. So there's two really, or three really interesting things here, William.
Well, let me get a clarification before you go through your three. What is American longhouse? That's a reference I don't get. And I'm sure I'm not the only one that don't get that doesn't get that. And then the second question is, the is ideologue really the right word to use there? Because I don't think she's a thinker. She's not an idealist.
Well, does an ideologue ideologue need to be a thinker, or can an ideologue just be a public
just
figure
parrot,
who people
yeah.
rally around that
yeah,
parody
yeah.
stuff?
Okay, then that makes sense to me. I was just that's one thing that didn't. Those are the two things when I read through the article, I was like, not sure if ideologue is the right word. There might be a better word. And then the American longhouse.
So with the ideologue thing, this goes to what I always say, where I always go like puppet master or true believer. Right.
Yeah.
And I always want to say like, who's the one pulling the strings and who's the one who's been duped and they really believe this. This goes into all us always wanting to believe everyone is Hitler. And what I mean by that is Hitler very clearly knew what he was doing, correct? Can we disagree with that? Like, do you disagree with me on that?
Yeah.
Right. And we assume everyone who
achieved it.
Right. And he knew his methods and everything. We assume everyone who's doing these things is as aware as he is. But I think that's a special level of evil. Right, of sociopathy, of lacking empathy, of being able to manipulate people. Whereas I think you can be an ideologue and also be a dupe. You can be one of the true believers.
Yeah.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
Now, as far as American Longhouse, I took it like as a metaphor. I didn't know what it meant exactly, but I took it as like this is the building everyone
the
lives
communal,
in.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
I'm the queen
and when
of
I
this
Google
communal
it,
space. Yeah.
Right. And when I Google it, it comes up that it's a Native American thing where it's a literally a long house. It almost looks like a barn. Think about, have you seen the movie The Village where when they have the wedding in the movie The Village and they're all in that almost barn-like structure?
Right, right.
You have no idea what I'm talking about.
I don't.
Well, stay tuned for more M. Night Shyamalan talk in Trailer Takedown.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, it's like that. So it's, you know, it's the idea that there's this one house, communal house that everyone lives in and they're in charge of it. But so my three things, can I go to my three things now?
Let's do it.
Did I satisfy your questions?
Yep. I'm ready to answer your three questions.
Well, I don't have three questions. I have three statements, which you can follow up on. The first is I find it infinitely amusing that what I was saying last time is already expanded upon, right? I was saying these people are duped to the point that they don't even understand that they're buying into this culture that's enabling this, right? That was my argument about Berliner. And we see the perfect example of it right now, and he immediately suffered the consequences of it where he had to resign. I have forgotten my second thing, but the third thing is much more important right now, is I love to quote the plain white tees, that this ends with relativism over truth. Because so many people stop at censorship over debate. But really what this is about is language doesn't mean anything. We use it to communicate what is relatively true to us rather than reality, so we can leverage we can leverage reality to get what we want. Now, what I was going to say is that goes into number two, which I had read a long time ago from a book sent to me from Midsider Katrina, if you remember her way back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
about how social justice warriors infiltrate these organizations through human resources. And now they've also set up DEI departments on top of human resources because they have no real skills and no real contributions. And that's where they can most get away with relativism, because then they can start talking about feelings and emotions and people's lived experiences. And you can't tell people what they didn't experience, and you can't tell them what their truth is.
Right.
So I absolutely
you can't argue against them. Right. I mean, I've tried to argue when a company I worked at wanted to take out merit as a core value. I was trying to argue with folks that were building the DEI department for the company about why that was hurtful to me, to someone in the that's supposed to be a protected minority, supposedly, right? And how removing merit would remove the exact ladder that got me to where I was.
Right, but then they started saying you have privilege as a gay man, right?
Now gay men have privilege, which is why I check that privilege on the show every Sunday.
Right. Yeah. And so I absolutely love, and this is the, you know, this is where I'm saying it's another sign of being past peak woke. The fact that somebody literally wrote an article that ended with that they're taking relativism over truth, that shows that somebody is valuing actual truth, actual reality, and they're starting to call these people out for what they are. That is a win, is it not?
I think so. How many more? I think that this is another boulder rolling down the avalanche that started with the Harvard chancellor or whatever? I think this is just a continuing avalanche of that, right? People are starting to connect these dots all over the place.
Well, that was one of the big stories we talked about in our year-end awards, right? That was one of our top five stories of the year. And we always notice how the stories we take as the top stories always, as you say, snowball or roll down the hill and build. And this is how it's building. And what you're saying goes into our next story, which, as you pointed out in the pre-show chatter we had, about how it connects to a story from years ago, right? So there's a big Google event this year where Google fired 28 employees. Why did they fire them? In the aftermath of protests over technology that the internet company is supplying the Israeli government amid the Gaza war, further escalating tensions surrounding a hot-button deal. So, William, I just want to say I don't really care what the technology is. What matters here is what happened. The firings confirmed by Google late Wednesday came a day after 9 employees were arrested during sit-in protests at offices in New York and Sunnyvale, California, after the company called police. So, essentially, these employees are saying, we don't like Google supporting Israel. They are committing genocide. They're participating in genocide. So we are going to have a sit-in protest. We saw this before, William. Yes, when people were like, oh, we need to boycott McDonald's and Starbucks and all these giant corporations for supporting Israel. It's the idea that anyone who is against Israel thinks everyone who is for Israel is supporting genocide. So Google, in a statement attributing the firing of the 28 employees to completely unacceptable behavior that, here's the important thing, prevented some workers from doing their jobs and created a threatening atmosphere. The Mountain View, California company added it's still investigating what happened during the protests, implying more workers could still be fired. And then, as I was just saying, a blog post, No Tech for Apartheid, see again, here we go, apartheid genocide, accused Google of lying about what happened inside its offices during what is described as a peaceful sit-in that received overwhelming support from other workers who weren't participating in the protest. This flagrant act of retaliation is a clear indication that Google values its $1.2 billion contract with the, here's the word, genocidal Israeli government and military more than its own workers. No Tech for Apartheid asserted. Here's my thing here, William.
Billion?
I don't know the truth or value of that or not. None of that matters, right? That, to me, that doesn't matter. What matters is the following. the idea that these people are speaking the same language that the NPR CEO is speaking. It's literally the same exact tactics, right? They call their thing a peaceful sit-in. They say Google is doing a flagrant act of retaliation. They are using coded language to put themselves in a morally superior position by relativistically portraying what happened. Whereas, here's where I say we're past peak woke, William. Google, by the way, a company that tends to be far left and would support this kind of behavior in the past, identified exactly what happened. They said it's completely unacceptable behavior because they stopped workers from doing their jobs and created a threatening atmosphere. Because here's the thing, William. Is Google saying their opinion is wrong? Is Google saying they don't have a right to their opinion? No. But what they're saying is the method of expressing your opinion matters. And you can't express your opinion in a way that is disruptive and harmful to our lives and our operations. And I think that is a huge win that they're saying it that way, because we're sidestepping the less important issue. And I know people are going to get mad at me. Oh, how is Israel versus Palestine a less important issue? I'm saying in the short term versus the long term. In the long term, the more important issue is people painting themselves as morally superior because
and
of their
victimhood. And
therefore
can do anything. Yeah.
Correct. You finished my thought. 100% correct.
100%.
Isn't that the win here, William? Do you disagree with that interpretation of this?
I think you are right on here.
William, my degree from FU says you are 100% correct.
I know.
Except it's me
here's
this time.
The thing. One small comment. So Alphabet's 2023 revenue was $307 billion with a B dollars. So I think $1 billion is a drop of the bucket. It would barely make the P&L statement from Israel. So yeah, maybe they care about that $1 billion. Or maybe they care about actually doing their fucking job. Because, Justin, I wanted to connect this, you know, as much as I've criticized Coinbase recently. If you remember, back in 2020, we had the story where Brian Armstrong, the CEO and founder of Coinbase, basically told people that wanted to bring politics about the George Floyd stuff into work to go pound sand. And he gave them a nice six-month severance and all this other stuff. Because he told them, hey, we're here to bring for the mission of financial freedom. And if you're not down with that cause and you want to bring other politics or have us do other things, then this isn't the place for you. This is our focus. And Google hasn't gone quite that far with this statement, right? They've only said like, hey, you disrupted our operations, and that's good enough, right? But we gave a lot of praise to Brian at the time for saying that, right? Saying,
well,
hey, this is political in the way of our mission, right? What is our company trying to do?
Right. And to be fair to Google with what you're saying, I agree with what you're saying, but I think Google was as explicit as it could be in public relations speak and in legalese. And what I mean by that is I think they're essentially saying the threatening atmosphere is by over-politicizing the company culture. But they're not saying it directly because they don't want to be sued for it.
But Justin, I have a question for you, because this is definitely pushing back against a left-wing cause, right? But this is left-on-left violence, right? And what I mean by that is I still don't think they're taking a principled approach to this, right? Like, this is... The reason I say that is we still know that they will fire people for not having the right political views, right? Not tweeting the right political views. That's still a thing at Google, right? All that AI word salad from the previous story, you have to have that stuff in order to get... to be a manager and get promoted at Google. Like, this is all stuff that came out post Damore and things like that, right? So is this an indication that that might be changing, or is this just it's just reached an overflow point that's going to get in the way of the bottom line. And now they can't look at it anymore, much like Hollywood and woke narrative
pedophilia.
Writing.
Pedophilia? Oh.
And pedophilia. Yeah, that too.
I don't know, man. Like, yeah, you're right. I mean, look, it's not perfect, but like, what do you want the culture to be like changed overnight? Like, you want to just snap fingers?
No,
like,
no. And I'm not
trying
to
disagree with anything you just said.
I understand, but I'm not trying to blackpill the situation. I'm just saying, hey, we've got to be vigilant here, right? Because today it's Israel. You know, the election is coming. We already know a bunch of people got fired. We covered these stories last election, right? People getting fired for posting pro-Trump stuff on Facebook, right? Somebody at Riot Games got fired. So a bunch of people at Google got fired. So we're approaching another election cycle. So what I'm afraid of, Justin, just to be super explicit, and I'm putting my crystal brain on this, is someone is going to tweet MAGA from a work computer at Google, and they're going to fire them, saying they created a hostile work environment. So that's my prediction. So I'm worried that this is going to cut back way harder, right? Like, this one is actually legit, right? And, you know, we can compare it to what's going on campus right now at Columbia University to Jewish folks and see where these protections actually will not be upheld, right? I mean, you want to talk about a hostile environment right now. Columbia University is it. Yeah. And none of those students that are protesting pro-Palestine are going to get kicked out of school, right? And it's no different from a workplace, I would say.
Look, I don't disagree with you, and I think that's a fair prediction as to what's going to happen. They're always going to try to weaponize and manipulate. That's what it's always been. And I mean, that's the greater long-term battle. That goes back to the, you know, relativism over truth. It's the idea that, look, and this is the, I don't know what color pill this would be at this point, but this is where I start to
rainbow.
Go like, well,
it's okay. We can have a rainbow pill, Justin.
That's fine.
I'll
rainbow pill,
I'll
whatever. I don't care. They're always after me Lucky Charms, right? Like, I don't know, dude, like, this is where I start to go like, well, maybe anarchy, because at what point are people going to figure out that like the flaw in the founding fathers' documentation and political approach was not any particular law clause like the general welfare clause or anything. It was simply that some people are always going to manipulate to use the monopoly on force for their own good. And is it even possible? Right. And is it even possible to protect against those people? And that's why I'm saying, that's why sometimes I'm like, well, maybe anarchy, because maybe the only way is to take away that monopoly on force. But then on the other side, I recognize the need for a impartial arbiter when there are groups that that disagree. So like, I get both arguments, and this is where I'm always stuck, right? Because the greatest battle, to me, the greatest battle in humanity is twofold. One, internal to yourself with your own self-esteem, and between people who want to use government and use the monopoly on force to hurt and control, and between people who don't want that to happen. To me, those are the two battles of humanity. Because the greatest irony of government is you use it to protect people, but by creating that power, you are enabling people who don't want to hurt people. Do you get what I'm saying?
Yep.
Speaking of which, I think that plays correctly or properly or perfectly into what happened in Florida this week, because it's on the line of like, we're past peak woke, but like, is this the right way to battle peak woke? So
forever purge.
It actually happened.
No, people would have you believe it did though, because oh my God, religion. So Ron DeSantis was down the street from the school I teach at. He was in Osceola County about half an hour. And it's only about half an hour because the school is at Toho Poliga, which, by the way, they use the Clemson. They're the Tigers. They use the Clemson paw. So stop it, Toho. But
trademark that.
Well, they use it without. I don't want to get started. But anyway, he was there. And it's half an hour away because they're like down like a winding road and past a bunch of fields or and stuff. Yes, you can still drive around here and it'll be like building cow pasture. It's one of the coolest things about living here. But he signed a bill into law involving religion and schools. And on that description, it sounds bad. But I want to delve into this because I think this is interesting. Okay, here's some paragraphs from a news story. Florida school districts will soon have the option of allowing volunteer chaplains to counsel students under a bill signed Thursday by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, who dismissed critics opposed to mixing religion with public education. The only requirements for a chaplain to participate would be passing a background check and having their name and religious affiliation listed on the school website. The chaplains would provide support, services, and programs to students as assigned by the district school board. The law takes effect July 1st. DeSantis stressed that the program is voluntary, schools don't have to have a chaplain, and students don't have to work with them. Parental permission would be required if they do. Supporters in Florida argued the legislation will provide another resource for children and pointed out that the chaplains already serve in other government roles by working with police and serving in the military. The legislator itself hosts a chaplain of the day when it's in session, and there's a non-denominational chapel in the state capitol. Opponents cite several problems with the new Florida law, including there being no training requirements for chaplains. They also fear...
They've never heard of seminary? I mean, I'm not saying it's a rigorous academic thing, right? But that's... it. Okay, whatever.
Well, it's the same concept of, like, in order to become a coach, not only do you have to learn the sport, but then you have to pass the state exams and the state training for being a coach. So that's what they're basically saying. You would need to get like a chaplain certificate. It's funny. Yeah. It's the idea that, yes, there is training. It's just not state mandated training. They also fear that some students might be ostracized if they are atheists or belong to a non-Christian religion in a Christian majority district. When you have a military chaplain, they go through intensive training and they have to be in the position where they can provide information which is factually correct and appropriate to the situation, said Democratic Senator Lori Berman of Palm Beach County. Without that training, a chaplain could provide psychologically damaging counseling, Berman said. She suggested schools add more social workers, guidance counselors, or psychologists if they need them. Now,
wait,
William.
Wait.
No. I think I know what you're going to say.
Okay.
Let me tee it up for you because I'm going to connect this to what we've already talked about, and I'm going to quote you to you to ask my question. Ready?
Oh, boy.
So, first of all, when we talk about being trained, right, by the government and by these elite organizations, aren't we just talking about being able to speak the AI jargon like the NPR CEO does? This is where we start talking about the NPR NPC. See what I did
NPR,
there?
NPC.
NPR
That's
NPC. Good. Right? Yeah. And, right, this is where we start talking about true believers versus the puppet masters, yes? But also, when we are talking about them complaining about religion, aren't you, William, of all people, the one who says that woke is a religion and social justice is a religion? And isn't everything we're talking about today and the protest to this story and the entire reason DeSantis is trying to pass this through because woke is a religion?
100%.
Yes. That's exactly where I was going to go.
Was I right? Yeah, I knew.
What are we talking about? That guidance counselors and psychologists and social workers, I'm going to push back even harder. Justin, how many social workers, guidance counselors, and psychologists are currently providing psychologically damaging counseling at the schools? I would say it's probably close to
100%.
Good use of the job. Well, yeah, that's the exact problem, William, right? This is where I'm saying, yes, we're past peak woke because we're identifying this problem, right? I think DeSantis is doing the best he can, and we're about to talk about how insane schools are in a minute here with a story from Ohio, right? But yeah. I think he's doing the best he can. Like, I think the things he's passed in Florida in regards to schools, and we even, you know, the parental rights and education bill, I think he's doing the best he can. But yeah. As you're pointing
and
out,
as an atheist, I'm okay with having chaplains, right?
Yeah, that was my question.
And here's why. I think it's a funny name, but if we look at it as spiritual leader, and as long as the denominations aren't discriminated, right? Like it's like volunteer, and it, you know, the school board says it's okay. I think you could have like a, you could have an atheist chaplain, right? There's no, nothing wrong with, in fact, I remember working with an atheist chaplain when I was deployed, right? Like it, that's not necessarily a bad thing, right? They're talking here about, I see it as let's get more quote unquote spiritual leaders into the school. I don't mean that in the woo woo sense, right? I mean that in the like upright men of upright character, especially if they were men, right? We have no male role models right now. I wouldn't see that as necessarily being a problem.
Well, the reason it's a problem is it's a threat to the people who want the corner on the market. I mean,
oh yeah, you can't have somebody come in and say, like, as much as I criticize religion and as much as it was rammed down my throat growing up, you know, there was definitely more parental and community involvement in education back then, right?
Wait, it was rammed down your throat? You didn't tell me you were an altar boy.
No, I wasn't Catholic. Milo.
Wow. And that's the thing, right? Like, the fear here is, are we going too far with allowing religion into schools as an antidote to the woke religion? But I think it needs to be a broader principle. And there was other stuff here that isn't really being discussed as much. And it's the idea of opening up these organizations or these schools to other organizations coming in and pitching themselves to the community and saying, we can make a difference, like Boys and Girls Club and 4-H and things like that. Things that used to be involved in schools.
Where yeah, you don't have any of that anymore, right? And you're looked at with suspicion. You're looked at with suspicion if you want to help a school and you don't have a kid currently in the school.
Right.
And I've seen tons of stories about that.
Right. And I think while DeSantis is trying to focus in on mental health, because that's obviously a major issue nowadays, and again, we'll talk about that in 2 seconds here with kids and what they're allowed to do and not to do in schools. And, you know, we talked about it before with, what was it, the helicopter school or the helicopter parenting article in Reason a while ago. I think it needs to be broader, where I just think you need more freedom of choice in regards to what organizations and what people are allowed to be influential on campus. Because now you have, oh, we hire a social worker, we hire a guidance counselor, we hire a psychologist, and we hire, you know, deans and assistant principals and administration. And these are the only people who are allowed to counsel and help these kids. And they have one specific way of doing it or one ideological way of approaching it. Whereas if you open it up here, which is what I think they're trying to do, then it gives more kids more opportunities to learn and experiment and be safe with things on all sides.
Yeah.
On all sides than it is to just say, oh, you can only have these people who go through this strict government test. I mean, it's the whole idea of, right, the Hollywood Union, of how hard it is to get into the Hollywood Union, and that creates all the same sort of talent and conversation and narrative in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's the one size fits all education, right?
Right.
This looks another chink in that. Yeah, as much as I dislike religion, this is definitely another chink in it. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, and likewise, I want to talk a little bit about how that affects kids. And what I mean by that is, I've been very critical of kids on this show, right? I've talked about what it's like as a teacher and their behavior, but we don't often talk about why they act the way they do and having some sympathy for them. And I think this article we just talked about and another article out of Ohio shows why we should have some sympathy for kids. And it shows maybe, William, maybe a little bit more why I teach, because I do have sympathy for them. So here's the headline. And this is a, I think this could have been a woke or joke headline. Student missing out on prom after bringing bag of chips to school. Is that a woke or joke headline there, William?
Yes. Yes, it is.
I mean, imagine you bring chips to school and then you can't go to prom. But if you follow the logic of why the school board did what it did, you understand the process they were following, and then it makes you question the process. So here's what happened. Someone gave the girl Takis chips on the school bus, and she was hungry, so she ate them. So the first thing I'm going to say, William, is before we even go deeper into this, this means she was taking the bus to school. So this means this was the morning. This means this was between 7 and 10 a.m. in the morning. You should not be eating Takis chips, first of all, at any time, really. But
that is not part of my complete breakfast, I don't think.
Right. It's not part of anyone's complete breakfast, right? And first of all, I didn't even have Takis growing up. Did you have Takis growing up?
I didn't have them until I was in California.
I didn't even know them in California. I came here and kids were eating Takis, and I'm like, those are disgusting. And dude, kids bring giant bags of chips to school. Not even fun size bags or single serving bags. They bring like, you go to the store, you go to Sam's Club, you buy like a $6 bag of chips, they bring that to school and eat it all day. Crazy. So there's a nutrition and health issue here as well. But that's not the main issue here, right? So yes, this is already exacerbated by like kids are eating Takis at 7 in the morning, right? That's a problem as is. But to her credit, she didn't finish the chips. She brought the bag inside the building and there were only two chips left. When she finished the remaining chips, she threw the bag away and went to class. Then the school principal called her down to the office, and at that point, they asked her if she ate the chips, and she said yes, and they suspended her for 5 days. Now, William, let's just take this story right here and stop. Can you imagine living in an environment every day where you could eat two chips and be suspended for 5 days?
Absolutely crazy.
Would that not harm your mental health? Would
now,
you not be living in fear?
I want to know. I want to know. Obviously, there's something. They said there's signs saying don't bring peanuts or whatever it is. Who is going to know? What kid is going to know which snacks have which allergens in them? Right. Like, what are we really trusting kids to read every food item before they bring them into the school? The ingredients, like they have an allergy. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think like dress code, they probably have a list of disallowed foods. I don't know. I obviously
right, but we don't know what the allergen is here, right? Is it peanuts, or is it? Do you see what I mean?
Like, I don't think it's peanuts.
Let's say it's corn oil or something, right?
Yeah.
It's not easy to figure that stuff out, right?
Right. Right. Well, but here, we'll get into that, right? But I just want to impress the point here. Not only was she suspended for 5 days, but they told her she couldn't attend prom either. Because, you know, the school I teach at has like standards of participation. If you have certain number of suspensions or tardies or absences or your grades are at a certain point, you're not allowed to do senior events like prom and grad bash and walk at graduation. I assume it's the same thing here. Right now, you want to hear what the school said? So the school said they have taken disciplinary action against a student for noncompliance with an established rule regarding food consumption on campus involving a staff member with a severe/life-threatening injury. The issue arose due to the student eating the allergen in an instructional area where such items are prohibited. Signage is posted in multiple locations notifying students, staff, and visitors of this sensitive and restricted area of the campus. The discipline measure is not an arbitrary restriction, but a necessary precaution to ensure the safety of staff member who faces severe, life-threatening allergies to certain foods. Under the guidelines outlined by the Americans with Disabilities Act, the school must safeguard the well-being of all individuals, including students and staff within the district, just as the district would attend to the needs of a student with life-threatening peanut allergies, that extends the same level of care and consideration to accommodate the allergies of staff members who work with our students and who have the right to a safe work environment. The school has taken proactive steps to communicate these rules since the beginning of each school year, with signage displayed throughout the designated area and formal acknowledgement process for students who will be taught in several restricted classrooms and a short hallway area. Every student who learns in this particular area of the campus, in conjunction with their parent or guardian, acknowledges their understanding of the prohibition on consuming products containing the allergen in the specified area by signing a written document. The school will continue to enforce our guidelines to provide the safest learning and teaching environment possible. So, William, I have two questions for you.
Okay.
One, if the teacher is this allergic, would it matter if the student ate the chips on the bus or in the hallway? Because if you ate it on the bus, would you still not have dust on your clothing and on your hands that could potentially fall off in the hall and hurt the teacher? And also, is this not an example of the issue with public school, with the application of the rule that I always complain about, that every student has to have the exact same accommodations, which means they all have to be in the exact same classroom, otherwise it's discriminatory? And what I mean by that is, if somebody can't work in the fields picking corn, see what I did there? I said corn, right? Because they're allergic to corn. Is that discrimination by a farm for not hiring someone who's allergic to corn? Or let me be less provocative with my phraseology there, as I was being. If you're allergic to pollen, so you can't work in an outside job, is a national park discriminatory towards you for not hiring you as a public, as a park ranger?
Yeah, I think the answer with the ADA is yes, that is discriminatory. And, yeah, I just can't get over this. This has to not be just completely out of the blue, right, Justin? Like, can you really just accidentally eat, or not even accidentally? It makes it sound, the article makes it sound like this student was not eating in the classroom, right? That she ate on the way to the classroom, right? Probably in the hallway in the designated no corn area, right? And then threw away the chips. Justin, you're absolutely right. It would be no different if they ate on the bus. If they didn't wash their hands thoroughly before entering the classroom.
And shake out their jacket or shirt.
Yeah. Then the danger is the same. In fact, Justin, I would argue that if they didn't have hand washing stations and make every student wash their hands before entering this secure area, that this is all just a farce.
Yes, well, that's my entire point. You just nailed my entire point of why I have sympathy for these kids. Because, on one hand, I recognize what you're saying. The kid knew and the kid was negligent. But on the other hand, are you really expecting the kid to be negligent about something such as, if we catch you eating these chips, you're going to be suspended for 5 days and miss prom? Because, how many other kids do you think we're negligent about not caring about such an insane rule, an insanely hard rule to police and an insanely hard standard to meet? How many kids do you think we're negligent about it and we're not caught? I mean, I see this with the cell phone rule all the time, right? Cell phones are supposed to be not out throughout school. But remember that movie about the animated movie about the kids with the pet robot? And his robot was broken and messed up and everyone else's wasn't. And in that, they had cubbies for them to put their robots in. If you were serious about these rules, would you not put a place for cell phones every day so kids couldn't take them out during school? Here is your locked cubby where we're going to put the cell phones in every morning so they're not an issue. Instead, you know kids are going to pull them out for 10 seconds when they're walking down the hall between classes. And is that something really we want to punish some kids for and some not? And it's the same thing here. If you were really serious about this, would you not inspect every kid's bag before going into this hallway? Like you said, not just hand washing stations. Would you not inspect every kid's hands or bags to make sure they don't have these kind of chips?
Yeah.
With dress code. Why is it if there's a dress code, kids are let into the building not in dress code? If you are not in dress code for a restaurant, do they let you in the restaurant?
That's what the maitre d' stops you for. Yep.
Right. That's what bouncers are for. If you're not in uniform for a game, does the ref let you play?
No. I remember when I was a ASO ref back in high school, I had to make sure everyone had their shin guards and their uniform was proper, right?
Right. So not only do we have these rules, which, as you're pointing out, are not properly applied, but they're not even actually being applied in a way that they're being treated seriously. So why would we expect the kids to take them seriously? And is it fair to punish them to such an extreme way?
Yeah. Something tells me this is the first time this student ate Takis chips. I can't believe that the first infraction of this is 5-day suspension.
I don't know, man. I would have to look more into the situation, but yes, I agree with what you're saying in principle.
That seems unreasonable too, you know?
But look, again, it's also the kids who care. And what I mean by that is I see the same kids do the same things every day, and to a certain extent, punishing them does no good. Because they're going to keep doing it.
Yep.
But you come down on a kid who cares, and then you feel like you're being effective and you're doing your job. So, again, we can criticize the kids, but look at the environment they're put in. Is this not an irrational environment?
Absolutely.
All right. Talking about irrationality, let's talk about some art in The Hopeful Bromantic with JML. Put me into syndication. Broadcast to a network station of people viewing their favorite episodes. I can't find a new pitch to throw the studio. If you'd like to continue the conversation with us during the week, you can do so by joining our Discord channel. In the Discord, you can witness some farce with us. You can tell us what farce you want us to witness. You can ask us questions both during the recording and after the recording of an episode. You can watch trailers when I post them. I usually post them on Saturdays. That's themidside.com or themidside.com/podcast. Click on any episode link and there will be a join code in there. Or if you know me, just text me and I'll send you the Discord join code. I'll make one specifically for you. I'll reach out on social media. I'm sure William can make a Discord join code on social media as well. So, all right, before we talk about some trailers, I briefly want to review the movie Abigail. Do you remember the trailers we watched for the movie Abigail, William?
I was surprised you didn't have Rebel Moon Part 2.
Well, I am not watching the non-director's cut.
Ah, okay. All right.
I'm not doing it. I'm done. Look, I watched the first part of Rebel Moon twice. It was fine. But I had the same reaction I had when I watched Batman versus Superman in theaters. It just didn't feel like a complete movie. So, yep. Why would I watch
something that's not completed? Yeah, I understand.
Right.
I'm with you.
And is it made for me? Those not completed cuts, are they made for me? Am I the intended audience of the not completed cuts?
Nope.
No. So I'm not going to watch it. So you are not going to hear from me about Rebel Moon. I haven't even reviewed Rebel Moon yet, have I?
No.
No.
Nope.
Because you know why? The director's cuts aren't out. So no one's going to hear from me about Rebel Moon until the director's cuts are out. And I know that's making some people mad because they want to talk to me about it. Too bad. Deal with
it. Too bad.
My happiness matters most of all. Okay?
All right. Abigail, remind me what the trailer was again.
So this is the one where a bunch of people kidnapped this girl and brought her to her house, and she turned out to be a vampire.
Okay.
She was the ballerina girl, and she was a vampire?
Yep.
Okay. Now, I hugged this trailer because I thought it looked good. What did you? Did you hug or tackle?
I tackled it. Yeah, I tackled it.
Okay. Well, here is my one-sentence review. Abigail's title performance and enjoyable plot design are undermined by large exposition dumps and dialogue. This was well done. The setup is well done. The idea that these criminals are kidnapping this rich guy's daughter in order to get a ransom for her, but then they find out that the girl is actually a really old vampire and she brought them all there in order to hunt them in a game, right? It's all well done. And the directing is good. The acting is good. The little girl who plays Abigail is tremendous. All the other actors are good. And it's very, very enjoyable. But I was taken out of it a couple times where there are a couple scenes where things are literally just explained. or hand waved away by lines of dialogue, or in those two big scenes, it's literally just two big scenes of one character explaining all the characters and why they're there and the plot mechanisms. And I just thought of the show Lost. And I, especially because they were like, and your name is actually Ana Lucia. They didn't say, oh, Ana Lucia Cruz, which is very close to Ana Lucia Cortez from Lost. And I was like, I know this movie would be longer, and maybe I'm just used to Zack Snyder movies, but how much better would it have been, William, if they had flashbacks showing how the characters, what life choices they made that caused them to end up in that house with that vampire, rather than, oh, you're here for this reason, and you're here for this reason, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Show, don't tell.
So is that a bit of naturalism peeking out?
I don't know. I think it's just bad writing.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call it naturalism.
We've seen a lot of bad writing. We've seen a lot of bad writing. I mean, Justin, the whole writer's strike is about making bad writing permanent in Hollywood. I know we've talked about it before, but, you know, requiring X number of writers if the show is going to be more than X episodes, and then requiring those salaries to be very large and required is just going to permanently make bad writing part of any movie and television show.
Yeah. So the characters make decisions. I wouldn't call it naturalistic, but it's just sort of like they had a lot of really good stuff here, and it could have been better than it was, but it was still pretty good. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense.
So ultimately, I gave this a solid bro rating. You know, this is, I mean, not that there's been a lot of great movies this year, but this is my number two movie of the year behind behind Ghostbusters Frozen Empire. But, you know, you saw the problems I had with that movie.
Yep.
I mean, it's ahead of the Mean Girls reboot, ahead of the American Society of Magical Negroes and Argylle. But then things get pretty bad after all those movies. So is it the second best movie of the year I've seen so far? Yeah, but there's not a lot of competition. So would I say, like, run out and see this movie? No. Would I say never see this movie? No. But if you get a chance, see this movie. Especially, you know, if you like Halloween Horror Nights type stuff, I wouldn't call it scary, but, you know, it's meant to be a vampire horror movie. I can see them doing a maze of this, a house of this at Halloween Horror Nights. So if you enjoy those kind of movies and, you know, you enjoy like Universal monster movies, you'll enjoy this. Is it a stupendous movie that you're going to be shocked by and love and one of the greatest movies ever? No, but not every movie, William, has to be the best movie or worst movie ever. Sometimes it can just be like, hey, this is a good movie. It's just got some problems in it. And that's what this is. Does that make sense?
Yep. Makes sense to me.
Okay. You want to move on to movies that are going to come out?
I'm ready.
All right. Do you need my spiel, or do you just want to hit Trailer Takedown?
Trailer Takedown. First trailer.
Protocol 7 is a movie with a really cool name, but then you start watching the trailer and you're like, fuck this. Right? When you realize, and I don't know if this is intentional or not, William, but this is about a company making a vaccine that doesn't work, and then there's actually a line in the movie where they say, we encouraged boosters. This is supposed to be about the mumps. Supposedly, this is based on a true story. I have no idea. But if I say Billions looks like, the movie Billions looks like people talking in rooms at each other, this looks like sort of Billions or somebody trying to do Oppenheimer by Christopher Nolan but not being able to do it well. You know, because visually, there was a lot that was important to what Oppenheimer was doing. I don't know how you make the research for faking the research for a vaccine interesting. There's just nothing about this that appealed to me. Tackle.
Tackle.
A dramatization that should have been a documentary. That's exactly the take that I had after watching this. I was like, this is going to be like a Law and Order episode, right? It looks tedious, so no thanks. Tackle.
Second trailer.
Hitman is a Netflix movie that I really don't understand. Now, William always complains that trailers show the entire movie. And I think the next trailer shows the entire movie. This trailer, I'm confused about, not because it shows the entire movie, but I don't fucking get it. William, correct me. Maybe there's something you can tell me. So this guy is like a fake hitman, but I don't get what the point of faking being a hitman is. Like, I liked the idea that it was like, hey, he can play all these different characters and like, but why? Why are you faking being a hitman? And then somebody tries to get him to be a real hitman. I really don't understand this movie. I watched this trailer and I said, I don't understand this. And it made me feel like an idiot. And for that reason, Tackle?
I was unclear whether he was like doing it for his personal kicks or doing it like as an undercover, like a sting.
Or, I thought it was for personal kicks at first, and then there were like three other characters who seemed to be his handlers, and then I was fucking confused.
I was confused as heck, too. So I think this movie, this is one of the rare trailers where it both gave away too much and didn't give you the essential at the same time. Does that make sense? Like, it didn't give you the hook, and it also gave you way too much, right?
It makes sense that it doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Yep. So... Tackle.
Third trailer.
You Can't Run Forever is kind of similar in that it shows the entire movie, but I don't get why he's hunting this one girl. So this is about J.K. Simmons being a, I guess, serial killer. And look, the selling point of this trailer is J.K. Simmons looks like he's doing a phenomenal acting job in this. He's going around and he's shooting people in cold blood. Essentially what happens is something happens with some woman who I thought was his wife. I'm not really clear on what happens, but then he goes crazy and he pulls up next to these people on the road and he's in a motorcycle. He gets them to pull over. The guy gets the girl to run out. He shoots the guy and then he's hunting the girl in the woods. And now they show most of this going on. They show most of the hunt, right? As I said, most of the trailer seems to be shown, but this is what I don't get. He knows the girl's name. He's on the phone or someone's on the phone with the mother. I thought there was some connection between him and the girl, but the girl is very Hispanic and J.K. Simmons is very white. So I am missing something here, but here's the deal. I can't, with how good this performance is by J.K. Simmons, just dismiss this outright. So this is a very soft Netflix and hug.
Netflix and hug.
Yeah, you know, this has great acting, it appears, and guns and chases and action. But Justin, I can't understand what they, like, what is this? What is this motivation, right? Like, this motivation is just completely muddled in this trailer. It doesn't make any sense. And on that alone, Justin, I am tackling.
Final trailer.
Trap is an M. Night Shyamalan movie. And William, should I just hug this right now because you know I'm going to hug it because it's M. Night, or do you want me to go into it?
Hug.
Hug. The hell? I don't even remember that one.
Hug.
What was the crying one? That sounds like he just like...
I don't know. That's the crying. The
sounds
crying.
Like he just like jerked off to like something that made him sad. Like, is that what that sound? Okay, so this, I find this movie to be very M. Night. And what I mean by this is I love the setup for this movie. But then I know there was a scene in the trailer that people are going to complain about, potentially you. And what I mean by that is, what the actor's name just from my head. Josh Hartnett. Josh Hartnett, who, William, I think he is acting phenomenally in this trailer. We're talking like Mel Gibson in Signs. We're talking Bruce Willis and all his movies with M. Night. We're talking about Mark Wahlberg in The Happening. And I know, oh my God, he just evoked The Happening, right? But I think he's tremendous in this. He brings his daughter to a concert at a major arena for a teen pop idol. So this reminded me very much of when I went to see Olivia Rodrigo at the former Amway Center, I don't remember what it's called now, in Orlando with my wife. So I was like, okay, hey, this makes sense. But then there's a scene where Josh Hartnett's character is talking to a merch guy, it looked like, and he's asking the guy, why are there so many cops here? And then the merch guy tells him, I really shouldn't tell you this, but this is all a trap set up for the serial killer, the butcher. All the concert and everything was even made just to get him to come here. And then it's revealed that Josh Hartnett is the butcher. Look, I love this setup. I love the idea that they're trying to catch him. This whole thing was socially engineered for him. But I know people are going to be like, why would the merch guy be in on the plan? And why would he know that? And, oh, the acting in here is sort of like The Village, where their lines delivery is very stilted. And why would, if he knew it, why would he just randomly tell this guy who happened to be the butcher? And you know what my answer to that is? Shut up. It works. It's needed for the trailer, for the premise, for the escalation. This is the beginning of the movie. Now, funny story. My brain decided to cross this movie with The Parent Trap the night after I saw the movie. So it or the trailer. So it replaced the little girl with Lindsay Lohan. And in the movie, there were two little girls who looked the same, and also two Josh Hartnetts who looked the same. And there were the good Josh Hartnett and the bad Josh Hartnett, and the whole movie was about them battling, and the trap was set up by the good Josh Hartnett, by the bad Josh Hartnett. So I don't think that was the movie about, but that's what happens when my brain crosses with The Parent Trap for some reason.
Nice.
Regardless, I think this looks great. So hit hug again.
Hug.
You know, I still don't forgive him for Avatar, but this looks interesting. This looks like old school M. Night, right? This looks like something that will have some twists that may be fun, and that's going to be an interesting story. So, yeah, I think I'm not going to hit the rule this week and actually going to hug a trailer. So I will hug this one.
Hug!
All right, William, that brings us to the end of our journey. What did we learn this trip?
That apparently I needed a chaplain in high school. Justin, what did you learn this trip?
That you needed a chaplain because you spent too much time around Catholic priests. No, I learned that apparently other people hate Takis too. They hate them so much that they will suspend kids and kick them out of prom because of it. All right, I want to thank everybody for listening to the show. If it wasn't for you, it would just be me talking to the corner of my closet like a crazy person. It still is that. You just make me feel a little bit less crazy. If you want to support the show, you can do so by going to midside.com or themidside.com/store or themidside.com/thecut. You can buy my novel there, themidside.com/patreon or themidside.com/locals. That's how you tell a friend. That's how we keep the lights on. And then you have to tell a friend, tell a female friend, tell someone on, what's the name of that app, William?
Fountain. We got a
Fountain.
300 listeners.
Fountainhead.
Yeah.
Telescope. 300 listeners. Sparta. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. This concludes your journey into the midside. I'm Justin Emblinski reminding you that if things get tough, take a step back and witness the farce.
Have a sunny day. Right after I get that drop that you want, I'm also going to get the drop of you saying your last name wrong. I'm going to try and gather as many of them as I can. That way we'll have them in file.
What, as many times as me saying my last name wrong or just a bunch of drops?
Just a bunch of you saying your last name wrong.
Then I mean, if like that doesn't give sympathy to other people. I mean, yeah, there's got to be throughout the years, yeah. Maybe I'll do Adam Carolla and just start saying it wrong every time on purpose.
Yeah, yeah. Corona.